Before we begin, we ask that you silence your cell phones and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue, so we invite all here to practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be. The session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We also hope you'll take the time to purchase goods from vendors, including booksellers like Benchmark Books, and please support Mormon Studies by supporting our vendors. The session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework. After the session, many attendees are gathering at the local Crown Burger. Please return on time for our plenary with Linda K. Klein, who will be speaking on the parallels between the evangelical and Mormon purity movements. And seats will fill up quickly. So about this presentation, over the course of Mormonism's history, followers of the Restoration have struggled with what to call themselves. This panel will explore the historical context of the label Mormon. And we have four great presenters. First, we'll have D. Michael Quinn. He is a Yale-trained historian researching a book titled Plural Marriage Among the Mormons, 1906 to 1926. We have Lindsay Hansen-Park, who is the host of the Year of Polygamy podcast and executive director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. Brian Buchanan works at Benchmark Books, an independent bookstore in Salt Lake City, specializing in Mormon history. He's interested in various Mormon history rabbit holes, particularly fundamentalist Mormon history and the 1890 to 1930 transition period. He also co-hosts the Sunstone Mormon History podcast with Lindsay, which is great if you haven't had a chance to listen to that yet. Then we have Ann Wild, who was raised in the mainstream LDS church and graduated from BYU in business education. She's been an independent fundamentalist Mormon for over 50 years, during which time she co-authored the book Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage, and was the managing editor of the fundamentalist magazine Mormon Focus, and was co-founder of the advocacy group Principal Voices. And now for the presentation.
In Palmyra, the nickname that the followers of Joseph Smith had was Mormonites. And I can't remember now when it first showed up in newspapers, but it appeared in a letter that was written by a German who was a minister in the Palmyra era and or area. And he used the term, although he was writing in German, he used the term Mormonites to describe Joseph Smith and his followers. And this letter was written in June 1830. It's one of the earliest manuscript descriptions of Mormonism by one of the recent relatives people living in the area of Palmyra, Manchester. The interesting thing is that looking at Mormonites, it continued to be a description of the followers of Joseph Smith for several years. And Alexander Campbell published an 1831 article about the Mormonites. And so whether it was in New York or in Ohio, where the LDS Church moved in 1831, there was a common reference point of calling them Mormonites. And there really, I see two origins of that use of the term. One of them is the Book of Mormon itself, which was released to the public officially in March 1830. And the term Mormonites couldn't legitimately be seen as referring in a contemporary way to the book's use of Nephites and Lamanites and other kind of ites, describing groups of people within the narrative of the Book of Mormon. And in that sense, the term was neutral in its application. It was being drawn from the book of Joseph Smith's production, in which he was called on the title page author and proprietor. But there was a longer tradition that was a negative tradition, and that is that in the terminology about religious groups, the suffix "ites" had a negative connotation. And to give you an example, those that did not have, that were mainly descriptive, but that did not have any negative connotation, were Calvinists, Methodists, also Presbyterians with the IAN, Catholics with and Lutherans with just a simple S on the end. But the ites term for religious groups, and this could even be found in a book that was in the Palmyra Library of A History of Religion, had the ites was restricted primarily to groups that were regarded as radical. And one of those was a Munsterite, and that referred to the Kingdom of Munster in the 1600s, in which a group of Anabaptists, and these were people who baptized adults rather than relying on infant baptism, they converted the entire leadership of the city of Munster, and in the process of that conversion, they created a millennial or premillennial kingdom within the city, and the members of the leadership began marrying polygamous wives, and eventually they turned their wrath upon non-believers, and there were beheadings that were going on, executions of various kinds, and Munster became the site of a battle. It was attacked by, it was one of the things that the Catholics and Protestants in Germany could agree on. We want nothing to do with these people. And so they came with cannons and rifles and all the kinds of murderous weapons and attacked Munster and successfully broke down its defenses. The king of Munster was John of Leyden, which later became part of the Netherlands. The non-violent, those who did not believe in the kinds of executions, who had been Munsterites, later formed two major groups. Initially, they lived in the Netherlands, and because they were not able to live in Germany after fleeing from the city of Munster, but they, many of them moved to the United States, and they are still known by the names that they were called in this period of time, the Hutterites and the Mennonites. But again, they had that ites ending to their name rather than being called Mennons or Hutterers or Mennonists or Hutterists, which were really terms that did not have a negative connotation. The ites term had a negative connotation. And so the use of Mormonites, even though it was possible to see it as a non-negative use of a Book of Mormon term, ites for Nephites and Lamanites, most of those who saw the term connected it with the negative connotation, not knowing anything about the Book of Mormon, not having read it themselves. Anyone who was a Baptist or Protestant of other stripes or Catholic, but most of the Americans at that time were Protestants, looked at the term Mormonites and saw it in a negative way. And so that became a point of reference for the followers of Joseph Smith from 1830 onward, that to have anything as a nickname that involved Mormon somehow was negative. And on that, I will turn the time over to the other presenters.
Okay, I'm just going to plug in my PowerPoint. Let's see if we can get this to work. Just give me a second. I appreciate that you talked about, Mike, about the "ite" being a negative connotation, because I've noticed that in my experience with working with Mormon fundamentalists, every once in a while, I'm a really salty Mormon fundamentalist, which are my favorite kind of Mormon fundamentalists, by the way, will be like, "Oh, are you just like a Monsonite, a Nelsonite?" And I'm like, "Excuse me? Like, do not talk to me in such a manner." You know, and then we like do this, we're like, "But you're the Peterson group," or whatever. It's like, okay when I do it, but not okay when you do it back. Okay, I'm going to talk about sort of the development of the term Mormon and Mormon identity post-Joseph Smith. And to do that, Brian is going to talk about modern usage of the term, but I am going to figure out how to, I don't have PowerPoint, how do I play this on here? Hold on. Nope. I have opened it, and now I need to figure out how to show you how to do this. Hold on just a minute. From the beginning. Okay. What am I doing wrong? There we go. Okay. So Brian's going to talk more about the modern usage, but I'm going to talk about how the LDS leadership has used this just a little bit, because I want to contrast it with ideas from the frontier. So what we have, this is a cover of the Ensign January 1979, where there is actually like a whole discourse talking about the name of the church. And that's interesting, because a lot of people with the new recent name change think it's sort of like this modern debate, and I mean modern, but like in the last year that it's mattered. But this is actually an interview with Richard Lloyd Anderson, who was a BYU professor, and they like gave him full platform, and this is still on LDS, it's not LDS.org, on the church's website, where they talk about the full name of the church. So he basically gives the LDS church's sort of official history of the name change. And again, Brian's going to talk more about this, but he gives a scriptural precedent for it. He talks about the Nephites and how they have to organize and call themselves the name of the church. And then here he sort of goes through like a history. Like first it started with the Nephites. You had to get the history of it. And then it started in May of 1834. And this is where they sort of come up with what they're going to call themselves. And then how we go into Kirtland. And this is what Mike Quinn was talking about, this Mormonite identity. And again, this is heritage history also coupled with like some documentary evidence about how the LDS church got to use the name Mormon. And then he goes through some more examples, and he basically backs this up more with scripture in the Doctrine and Covenants to say this is why we have this name, and this is why we do what we do. And so that appeared in 1979, and then we have, also we know, let's see, he quotes this is John Smith, which was Joseph Smith's uncle, talking to his son in a letter, and he gives another example of why they're using the name of the church. And then anyone that's LDS, I'm going to, and I apologize for people who aren't LDS, we're just going to talk about this, because I, as an LDS person, find it interesting the contrast between how LDS leaders talk about identity and how it's used today. So then we have our current prophet is Russell M. Nelson. But in the time that he made these statements, he was just a member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, and this is May 1990, and this is a famous talk that he gave where he sort of talks about the framing and the rhetoric of how the church is. And are you going to talk about this talk? So I don't want to cover it too much. But basically, he makes a distinction, and I've spent a lot of time trying to think about the difference. He says he wants to talk about the difference between a name and what the church is called. And I'm still trying to figure out what that means, so maybe you can solve that mystery for us, Brian. But anyway, so he's talking about the callings, and he, like the 1979 article, he's referring to scriptural basis. This is why it's important. A name actually does matter. It's not something that's just cosmetic. And so, of course, later on, Nelson is the one that's changing the name of the church. And so now I'm going to contrast that with the frontier period and Brigham Young. And if you haven't seen Jan Chipps's article signifying sainthood and you're interested in this topic, this is like a really critical article for you to understand sort of Mormon identity and the name of the church. And she goes over that. But she has a really interesting idea, and this is what Mike Quinn was kind of talking about, is that Mormons have to establish themselves as something different. There are all these religious movements happening. It's very fertile soil for this, you know, different churches are popping up everywhere. So what makes you different? What makes you better? So essentially, you know, Joseph Smith, who's prophet, seer, and revelator, is also now having to be a marketer, right? He has to find a branding problem, solve a branding problem of what sets us apart. Jan Chipps has a really compelling thesis that talks about how Mormon identity has to become peculiar to set itself apart. And that's kind of one of the points she brings up in her article. And I want to extend that a little further. And I want to suggest that especially one of the things I say when dealing with Mormon fundamentalists that I work with is I always say that the LDS Church is a lot more closely, and this makes everyone uncomfortable, more aligned with the FLDS than they are with the RLDS, or the Community of Christ. Our theology, our doctrine, our culture resembles Mormon fundamentalists more than it does the Emma's Church, who stayed over in Nauvoo. And everyone gets uncomfortable with that because they're like, no, 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 we don't want to be like that. But what I mean is, in some ways, if you have gone to even an RLDS who still keep a lot of the traditions, or Community of Christ congregation, it's a lot different. It's a lot more traditional Christian Protestant religion in format, in theology, and I've always been curious about that. Well, I'm going to argue that, especially after Joseph Smith's death, Brigham Young didn't just need, as Jan Chipps suggests, to establish the church as a legitimate church. But Brigham Young had some anxiety about the role and legitimacy of himself as a prophet. And so I argue that he is not only trying to establish a legitimate movement, but establish himself as a legitimate successor and someone who is capable of running God's church. So he comes up with a lot of these Mormon identity markers that I don't think that we really see with Joseph Smith, at least like not institutionally practiced or used until Brigham Young. And we can talk about the you know, pressures and that shape the theology that Brigham Young sort of contends with. And I want to argue that it's based on the lack of security that Brigham Young felt to prove himself. So if we look at it that way, if we look at Mormon identity as sort of the consequence of Brigham Young's anxiety, then it opens up some interesting avenues for us. So his leadership would be a generation obsessed with proving Mormons to both be separate and peculiar, but also those who have a legitimate claim to God's kingdom. And not only God's kingdom, but legitimate heirs to God's as co-creators, right? Like, the reason why Mormons are a little bit better and a little bit different than, say, any other Christian sect is because we are an ancient house restored. And because of that, Mormon identity becomes completely tied in with loyalty. And I often argue publicly and otherwise that Mormon faith can be also interchanged with the word loyalty, how we understand loyalty. Loyalty, if you exchange the word faith with loyalty, things get really interesting. You can go to an LDS congregation, and you can have doubts, or you can maybe have weird ideas about Joseph Smith, and nobody cares. They only care if you talk about it. And that's where we get into some tricky territory, because it's really, faith isn't actually this verb of what you do believe or what you don't believe, or an active journey towards something. It's about how loyal you are to the institution in Mormonism. And I really see that coming from Brigham Young's leadership, where he's trying to establish control and legitimacy as a leader. So this is from Jan Chipps. She talks about Mormon identity needing these four markers. Brigham Young is trying to establish Mormons as a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, and a peculiar people. And she said, I think this is a really important quote. She says, "Unlike the members of most other Christian groups who treated this heritage symbolically, the followers of the Mormon prophet put on these titles quite literally. As the first saints in a new dispensation, they became the very embodiment of a chosen generation. Their birthrights as chosen people were secured by revelation, and they had a royal priesthood. Moreover, those saints who accepted the leadership of Brigham Young and followed him west established themselves as a holy nation. They constructed a kingdom in the top of the mountains, naming their holy nation the State of Deseret." Okay. So I got sort of interested in this idea of what does it mean? Why is Brigham Young so interested in using terms that we don't see, royal priesthood, holy priesthood, peculiar people, and what mechanism that has? And I think that Mormon identity, because of this idea that Brigham Young is struggling for control in early frontier Utah. So they get here. Brigham Young would have said in 1857, this is from Journal of Discourses, he says, "I don't profess to be such a prophet as were Joseph and Daniel, but I am a Yankee guesser." And I love that. I love that quote. Yankee guesser. 1857, he compares himself to two prophets, Joseph Smith and Daniel. So there are some tensions that we're dealing with here. And one is the idea of this modern, new, restored church. We're new. We're different. We're not like the other guys. Like, this is the branding thing. Also, we're old and we're the same as the ancients, right? So now you have to brand yourself as like this new thing, but it's new thing because it's super, super old and it's like the true old thing. So he brings up Joseph and Daniel, and we actually see this rhetoric. If you go through some of his revelations, his sermons in between the 1850s and 1860s, he's constantly going new to old, new to old, new to old. And we like, you know, skip out everything in the middle. And so this is a quote where he's talking about royal priesthood, and you can find this. He starts, and I argue that Mormons understood their identity to be a radical act, a new sect set apart and different from other faith traditions, and yet legitimized by being the restored faith of the ancients, right? Okay, so some of these markers are garments. We start to see Brigham Young tie the rhetoric of royal priesthood to garments, holy garments of the priesthood. He starts talking about holy priesthood a lot, as it has to do with dress and standards. So this becomes one of the signals of how you can identify yourself as a Mormon. And I also want to argue, talking about Brigham Young's anxiety, I mean, Brigham Young literally positioned his house, his property, at the top of all the water in Salt Lake City, right? City Creek. He was there. He defied, like, anything above him in Salt Lake City defied gravity, so the water wouldn't come down into the valley. So Brigham Young controlled the waters. And so what this means is proximity to power determines your survival. And this idea of Mormon loyalty, we always do this. Everyone, when they give their Mormon credentials, they're like, you know who I'm a neighbor with? I'm a neighbor with Elder Holland. And everyone goes, oh my gosh, you must be important because you're neighbors with Holland. And there's this idea in Mormonism, and it's a human idea too. It's not, you know, exclusive to Mormonism, but proximity to power gives you power, right? And I would argue that this anxiety that Mormons feel comes from a literal survival mechanism. To survive in frontier Mormon Utah, Brigham's cooperation was pretty essential. And if it wasn't, you didn't have water, you know? So making sure that you were aligned with him in a way that led to your survival, I think, was important to a lot of people. And of course, some people didn't align with Brigham, and they survived. But I would say in frontier Utah, especially during these times leading up to the Mormon Reformation, you wouldn't do very well if you didn't adapt to this Mormon way of life. So signaling becomes super important. Garments, what we wear. And we start to see, especially after the Steptoe Expedition, where this is before Johnson's army comes in, soldiers come in, there's all these women being married, and then their husbands are leaving on missions, or they're with other plural wives, and we have a lot of neglect in the 1850s and 1860s of these plural wives. These cute soldiers show up, they get a little tempted, and we start seeing Mormon women going off as soldiers. And I've argued this before, especially in my podcast, that Steptoe's expedition, especially when we see Heber C. Kimball's own wife and Brigham Young's daughter-in-law, you know, tempted by these soldiers, almost taken away in the dead of night, that the rhetoric about Mormon women starts to change. Now all of a sudden women are supposed to dress more modestly and supposed to cover up, and women are can't be trusted, and they have to be protected, and they're not these like delicate creatures on pedestals. Now they're sinful, and we need to watch their sexuality. And that happens to do with Mormon identity. So Brigham ties Mormon identity with dress. And another big thing with royal priesthood was plural marriage. This was something that made us a peculiar people. We had things like the, you know, Order of Enoch, Law of Consecration that set us apart. Mormon fundamentalists still have that as a marker, something that they consider the higher law. Excuse me, and plural marriage is also one of those. So he ties plural marriage to this royal priesthood. And in doing so, Brigham starts to establish Mormon identity is not just performative, right? It's not just about what you wear. It's about your actual bloodline. It's a royal lineage. So if you join us in this new thing, you're also tied to the ancient order of royalty, right? You're of the house of Israel, a royal seed, a royal blood. This is another thing from Jenship. She talks about the chosen generation or chosen people. And I think this is really interesting because if you're developing these markers, what this means is to develop an in-group, you also have to establish an out-group. And this is where we start to see Jenship talks about this time period where the word Gentile starts being used. So now we have an in-group and we can tell us apart. So now we're going to call outsiders Gentiles. And we see it in the rhetoric of everyone being called a Gentile as an outsider. And that's it for me. Okay. So one last thing I want to say is, according to Steve Taysom, he's talked about the Mormon Reformation, and he argues that the Mormon Reformation, which is a two-year period in the 1860s, he argues that it was a constructed crisis by Mormon leadership. So mainly Brigham Young and his sledgehammer, is what they called him, Jedediah Grant, his counselor, to orchestrate a crisis to codify Mormon identity, to keep people cohesive. So you got to look at, Mormons get here in 1847. They're really excited. They have a rough few years, bad winters, crickets and locusts, the plague, it all comes. And they're starving. And you have saints coming over from England, and they're leaving their green English home to Deseret. And Deseret is dry, and it's miserable, and there's disease, and people are starving to death. People are upset, and we have stories of apostates, people leaving in the dead of night, whole wagon trains of people showing up with their feet bleeding because they have, like, if you left Mormon Deseret at the beginning, you left with nothing. And Brigham Young made sure of that. And there are several stories. I think you can read them in, what's the Swords Point? What's the name? The Blue Book. About, yeah. At Swords Point. You can read stories about people that left during this period. If you left, sometimes your barn would be burned down the night before, like you left in dead of night. And of course, that isn't across the board, but there was definitely a fear of insider-outsider rhetoric. And, you know, the outsiders were going to come and encroach, and this leads to the Utah War. So Steve Taysom calls Latter-day Saints and the Mormon Reformation a constructed crisis. And that is where we see Mormon identifiers really ramped up. So this is when they developed the, you know, the catechisms that I now call home teaching, where they would send two visiting elders to your ward. This is where the idea comes from. They'd send them around and they would ask you these catechisms. And some of them were like, do you bathe? How do you bathe? How do you dress? What do you eat? And some of them were about your morality. And it was a way to keep people in and out because the end was near. And this is when we have people in the Bowery whipping each other with, what are they called? What? Sure. Didn't hear it, but I believe you. So, this is where people, Jedediah is telling people to confess their sins, and they're confessing sins that they didn't even commit, and Hannah Tapfield King writes in her journal, like, this is going too far. And you know it's going too far if Hannah Tapfield King says it's going too far. So people were really trying to really, like, ramp up this religiosity, and Steve Taysom said that Latter-day Saints relied on a, quote, episodic, crisis-driven tension model to sort of codify their identity. And I think, so that's my argument, that Brigham Young's anxiety of his own legitimacy leads to having to deal with this challenge of this new organization. Who are we? What sets it apart? Why am I, like, I'm Joseph Smith, but I'm not Joseph Smith, so what are we going to do differently? And that is where I argue we get these Mormon identifiers. So that is my piece.
I just want to point out at the beginning there's institutionalized prejudice against people of my size here, just so we're all clear. Thus shall my presentation be called, of Strangite Fields of Dreams and Molotov Cocktails, Mormonness from 1900 to the present. Jim Croce taught us many important lessons in the 1970s. He crooned at us, I've got a name, and I carry it with me like my daddy did. Names are important. This was impressed on me a few years ago when I came across this. I immediately sent a picture to Lindsay and said, Strangite baseball field. Of course, it wasn't. It was just a field next to an LDS church in Utah County with a sign created by someone who wasn't aware of the critical importance of a hyphen and a lowercase d. Okay, let's set up where we begin here. So when Lorenzo Snow died in 1901, the LDS church consisted of 50 stakes, 292,931 members of record, 21 missions, and 6 temples. Very different church than what it is now, but also you can see how much it had grown in 70 years. So the dawn of the 20th century was a relatively quiet period following the anti-polygamy crusades of the 1870s and 1880s. With the long-sought arrival of statehood in 1896, it seemed like the course was set for calm progress. But the future of the LDS Church would forever be changed with the election of Apostle Reed Smoot as senator in January 1903. After several years of hints that he would do so, Smoot ran for senator as a Republican. By a 4-1 margin, he defeated 3-term incumbent Joseph L. Rollins, son of a Mormon mother. Smoot's seat in the Senate was immediately challenged. And remember that just 4 years earlier, a deadlocked Utah legislature had failed to elect a candidate, and the seat went vacant for the whole term. Within a week of Smoot's election, opposition began to gain momentum. A petition was backed by various officials, both in public and religious spheres, including the mayor of Salt Lake City. This backlash quickly led to a lengthy series of hearings in Washington as to whether Smoot should be allowed to keep his seat. And remember, this is not even a generation after the widely publicized end of polygamy in 1890. And so the testimony from these various LDS officials that are called back to the nation's capital made for a great copy in the newspapers. Statements like this from First Witness Joseph F. Smith obviously got people's attention. I have never pretended to, nor do I profess to have received revelations. I never said I had a revelation, except so far as God has shown me that so-called Mormonism is God's divine truth. That is all. Not surprisingly, folks back home were not all on board with Smoot and the impact that his election had brought. Church leaders were not exempt from the division of feeling regarding the apostle senator. Late in the hearings, Charles Nibley, who would be called into the presiding bishopric the next year, was discussing the hearings with church president Joseph F. Smith. As Nibley later recounted, I took the position that it would be unwise for Reed Smoot to be reelected to the United States Senate. I was conscientious in my objection, and I had marshaled all the facts, argument, and logic that I could, and I was well informed, I thought, on the subject, and had presented them to him in as clear and yet in as adroit a manner as I possibly could. It would take too much space here to go over the arguments, but it seemed to me that I had the best of it. I could see he began to listen with some little impatience, and yet he let me have my say, but he answered in tones and in a way that I shall never forget. Bringing his fist down with some force on the railing between us, he said in the most forceful and positive manner, if ever the Spirit of the Lord has manifested to me anything clear and plain and positive, it is this, that Reed Smoot should remain in the United States Senate. He can do more good there than he can anywhere else. What do you say to the prophet at this point? The hearings continued, and Smoot was finally allowed to retain a seat. But the LDS Church emerged from the hearings with a course change plotted. As historian Kathleen Flake outlines in her excellent book on the Smoot hearings, The Politics of American Religious Identity, the LDS Church began to forge a new identity, that of an ultra-patriotic, more assimilated, and acceptable form of Christianity. This identity was based on three criteria. First, Mormon abandonment, indeed in 1906, not merely word in 1890, hold that thought, of polygamy vouchsafed the church's subordination to the state. Second, the church demonstrated by both benevolent actions and military enlistment that it created loyal citizens who could contribute to the nation's common good. The third criterion of tolerance, or the privatizing of its truth claims in deference to those of others, was limited to the political arena. The Senate was satisfied by the implementation of a more democratic process in Utah government, and, on the eve of the Smoot hearing, the announcement by the church that it was not a political institution with political objectives. Now, as he is occasionally known to do, Mike Quinn has demonstrated that that first criterion is not quite that simple. As you may have heard earlier, he is continually identifying more plural marriages that occurred after the second manifesto with authorization. Now, with that said, the Smoot hearings did toll the death knell of the first LDS identity we'll mention today, Mormon equals polygamist. Within a few years of the second manifesto, polygamy had moved decisively into the realm of a growing body of people who would eventually coalesce into various fundamentalist Mormon groups or independents. And if that's of interest, I've heard there's a podcast that addresses this, maybe even a year or more's worth. So now what? What kind of identities would rise up to replace the 19th century concept of Mormonism? As the century progressed, Mormon equals family would be a very common identification. Just as it happened with polygamous families, LDS people were still known for larger than average families, just on a slightly different scale. And occasionally, very public examples of this captured the national attention, most obviously the Osmonds. Now, I'm sure there's someone out here who could name all of them, but I'll cheat for you. There were 9 children: Jimmy, Verl, Tom, Donnie, Alan, Wayne, Merrill, Marie, and Jay, in no particular order. All of them who took part in the family entertainment business in some way. So to much of the world, the Osmonds become shorthand for Mormon. Clean-cut, polite, and family-oriented, and obviously white. Okay. Now, associated with the clean-cut family look, people increasingly began to recognize Mormon equals word of wisdom. As the 20th century progressed, the revelation issued, quote, not by commandment or constraint, slowly attained that exact status. As historian of the topic Paul Peterson noted, under Heber J. Grant's leadership, the revelation came to be regarded as a binding principle, a test of individual obedience and worthiness, and a requirement for a temple recommend. From this point forward, we start to hear of ensign-worthy stories of Mormons who conspicuously refused coffee, tea, and alcohol, which was noticed by their Gentile observers. One of my favorite examples comes from a Time article on professional golfer Billy Casper, who was a convert to the LDS Church. William Earl Casper Jr., 35, used to be a fat, sick Congregationalist who won a lot of money playing golf. He is now a slim, healthy Mormon. Nothing else has changed. And as we move closer to the present, such observations about Mormon celebrities become de rigueur in newspaper and magazine articles. But in addition to these identities, which an outside observer would classify as positive, there are others that are not quite so happy. The temple and priesthood ban for those with African ancestry had never really attracted much attention by outsiders, being that it coincided with the dominant national perspective, until the civil rights movement begins to gain momentum in the mid-20th century. Now, there were some LDS members during this period who questioned whether this is really part of their identity. For example, in a letter to a friend, sociologist Lowry Nelson wrote, "Your letter is the first intimation I have had that there was a fixed doctrine on this point. I had always known that certain statements had been made by authorities regarding the status of the Negro, but I had never assumed that they constituted an irrevocable doctrine. I hope no final word has been said on this matter. I must say that I have never been able to accept the idea and never shall. I do not believe that God is a racist." But once the national trend towards civil rights began to diverge from the LDS position, the divide began to come into focus. Interestingly enough, this was manifested very publicly with BYU sports. Long before we had Max Hall hating Utah fans or John Beck crying about having his weekend ruined, go Utes, there were much more serious stories regarding the folks in blue. In the late 1960s, Harry Edwards, a professor at San Jose State, which had also produced Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who, in the iconic moment, raised the Black Power salute at the 1968 Olympics, told BYU broadcaster Paul James, "If Mormon dogma regarding the blacks has not changed, anybody who goes with the BYU football or basketball teams had better wear a hard hat and an asbestos suit. Whatever conference BYU is in, we will destroy." A series of protests followed. In 1968, 8 members of the UTEP track team refused to participate in a meet involving BYU and were promptly dismissed from the team. Similarly, black players on the San Jose State football team sat out in protest, supplemented by picketers at the game. Various games against BYU and other sports were canceled. In 1969, 14 football players at the University of Wyoming were immediately dropped from the team for their plans to wear black armbands during the game against BYU. The basketball season was even more heated. Eggings, chemical-filled balloons on the court, chants and signs. Then, in a game against Colorado State, roughly 100 protesters took the court, and the mood immediately got ugly. Out of the stands, in prophetic fulfillment of Dr. Edwards' warning to Paul James, a Molotov cocktail sailed onto the court, but it was extinguished before it exploded. BYU president at the time, Ernest Wilkinson, who disliked having to put out fires, as it were, had to deal with this identity of Mormon equals racist. His most successful solution was to send out Darius Gray as an ambassador. If you know, and have therefore hugged Darius, you already know why this was a winning proposition. Put yourself in Darius' shoes, though. Think about what he had to do. Bless him for that and for 100 other things. Things calmed down eventually, but this identity of Mormon equals racist persisted. Moving on, Mormons have always booted people from their fellowship from the beginning. However, those were usually in-house affairs. Toward the end of the 20th century, church discipline began to take on a national flavor. In 1979, Sonia Johnson was excommunicated in Virginia for her opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment. Many observers, no doubt unaware of the coordinated institutional opposition mounted from Salt Lake, likely wondered why the LDS Church would unchurch someone for opposing the following proposal. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. From this point on, another identity developed. Mormon equals excommunicate. And if you don't think that's a word, I'll fight you. 14 years after Johnson was invited out, 6 persons were quite noticeably disciplined, a group quickly dubbed the September Six. And closer to the present time, in a social media world, high-profile excommunications of Kate Kelly, John DeLynn, Denver Snuffer, Sam Young, and even high church leaders like Hans Mattson and James Hamula have attracted worldwide attention. To a non-Mormon observer, these actions might seem violent, something out of its time. Now, we can't discuss the concept of Mormon identity without discussing the recent emphasis on using the full name for the LDS Church. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that is. This obviously didn't happen in a vacuum, so let's wander through some of the developments in this regard. Throughout the 20th century, there were periodic calls from church leaders to avoid the term Mormon. Here are a few examples. Let it be remembered that the term Mormon, with its derivatives, is not the official designation of the church. The proper title of the organization is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. James E. Talmage, 1901, in a talk ironically entitled The Philosophy of Mormonism. I thought that was fun. The Latter-day Saints are called by the world Mormons. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is called the Mormon Church. Why it should be so is a question. Mormon had nothing to do with the organization of this church. The Lord Jesus Christ organized it. It is not the Mormon Church. It is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. George Teasdale, 1902. Don't let the Lord down by calling this the Mormon Church. He didn't call it the Mormon Church. It is all right for us to believe in the Book of Mormon. He expects us to do that, but he told us what to call this church. That's my guy, George Albert Smith, 1948. Though this may be called the Mormon Church, it is not the Church of Mormon, nor is it the Church of Joseph Smith, nor of Brigham Young, nor of any other man. It is the Church of Jesus Christ, Hubie Brown, 1960. Now, let's focus on the last 40 years in this regard. In 1979, First Presidency Counselor Marion G. Romney discussed the name of the church in a general conference address. Members of the church do not resent being referred to as Mormons, nor does the church resent being referred to as the Mormon Church. As we have said, however, it is not the correct name of the church. But notice that he stops short of indicating that using the term Mormon is somehow unrighteous intrinsically. The first official word on the question came in a 1982 First Presidency statement on missionary work, interestingly enough. Keep in mind that this is the Church of Jesus Christ. Please emphasize that fact in making contacts with others. The Lord revealed that the church should bear the name, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We feel that some may be misled by the too frequent use of the term Mormon Church. But despite these, it seemed to be pretty much a dead issue. Then, in 1990, Russell Nelson, who had been an apostle for 6 years by that point, began to signal his intention to ensure usage of the full name of the church. In a general conference address entitled, Thus Shall My Church Be Called, he opened by saying, "We are all pleased when our names are pronounced and spelled correctly. Sometimes a nickname is used instead of the real name, but a nickname may offend either the one named or the parents who gave the name." So notice the introduction of a key new element there. Using the incorrect name of the church would offend God. Then, 6 months later, Gordon B. Hinckley, who was then first counselor to church president Ezra Taft Benson, felt that Nelson's words needed some nuancing. He described Nelson's message as an excellent address and noted to the audience, quote, "I commend to you a rereading of his talk." But Hinckley then proceeded to speak more to realities than to ideals. He declared, "I suppose that regardless of our efforts, we may never convert the world to general use of the full and correct name of the church. Because of the shortness of the word Mormon and the ease with which it is spoken and written, they will continue to call us the Mormons, the Mormon Church, and so forth." Noting wryly that, quote, they could do worse, he then told a very revealing story. "More than 50 years ago, when I was a missionary in England, I said to one of my associates, how can we get people, including our own members, to speak of the church by its proper name? He replied, you can't. The word Mormon is too deeply ingrained and too easy to say. He went on, I've quit trying. While I'm thankful for the privilege of being a follower of Jesus Christ and a member of the church which bears his name, I am not ashamed of the nickname Mormon." Now, given what has taken place since then, I think it's fair to assume that Nelson had to have been gritting his teeth at that point. Hinckley then referred offhand to the, let's say, linguistically dubious 1843 statement published in the Times and Seasons that Mormon actually means more good. Hinckley, of course, realized the definitional issue, but suggested that a mental connection of the two was still nevertheless recommended. He concluded, quote, "We may not be able to change the nickname, but we can make it shine with added luster." Now, you might be interested to know that Russell Nelson hasn't always felt the way that he does now. His autobiography, From Heart to Heart, published in 1979, is littered with uses of the term Mormon, Mormon Church, Mormon missionaries, and so on, including, cue the gasps, three lines from the bottom, he refers to himself as a Mormon. A year later, interestingly, he gave a devotional at BYU while still president of the Sunday school entitled, What's in a Name? While he did not comment on the Mormon versus full name conundrum, he did note, quote, "Beware of nicknames that are uncomplimentary and offensive." So given all this, you kind of wonder if he had a nickname that he hated as a child. Because he keeps mentioning nicknames and this offensive part of it. It's such a common, consistent element of the way he talks about it. So a decade after his conference address, with the 2002 Winter Olympics coming, church leaders began to go back to this question. In January 2001, a summary was prepared, apparently by Dallin Oaks, as an outgrowth of some talks that had happened in the Public Affairs and Missionary Executive Councils. Several points of interest from this summary. He suggested that the following statement could be included with church news releases, quote, "The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the official name of the church whose members are sometimes referred to by others as Mormons. While the church does not shorten its official name, the contractions the church or the Church of Jesus Christ are acceptable in news stories when required by space limitations." And he also noted that, quote, "the church should never use Mormon Church and should strongly discourage the use of this term by the media and others." Now, this is interesting. Lindsay was like, it's at LDS.org. Wait, it's not LDS.org. Back then, already, he was hinting that the church URL might be changed to the Church of Jesus Christ. And then finally, he said that Mormonism was acceptable in discussing the, quote, effect of doctrine, culture, and lifestyle, but Mormon fundamentalist absolutely was not. Big surprise. So despite all the mentions and statements, including another one in 2001, the same time this was prepared, language on using the full name of the church did not appear in the Handbook of Instructions until 2006. Few points of interest from this. The use of the revealed name is increasingly important. Should use the full name whenever possible. Mormon Church is discouraged, but Mormon is acceptable. And then, but he did admit that the church might need to use Mormon in other areas around the world, as it is most commonly known by that term. But then, in 2010, the broad-based multi-million-dollar I'm a Mormon campaign launched. And I found it interesting that exactly 20 years after Nelson first discusses this idea in conference, in-house ownership of Mormon hit its high water mark. Again, one has to assume that Nelson was again gritting his teeth at such a coordinated institutional program that, to his mind, was so clearly offensive. A year after the launch of I'm a Mormon, Michael Otterson, then managing director of the church's public affairs department, said the following in an interview. And again, kind of like Hinckley's conference talk, note how he speaks more to realities, even some technical ones, rather than ideals. The game changer has been the internet, because people don't search for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or LDS, or Latter-day Saints. They search for Mormon. And if you want your material to be seen, then that's what you're going to have to do. I hate to use the word brand, because it sounds so corporate, but if we have a brand, it ought to be that our people are following Jesus Christ, that we are representing Jesus Christ and his gospel and his teachings and the way we live. If that is established as what we want to be known for, then having people associate the word Mormon with Latter-day Saints and with Jesus Christ makes sense rather than avoid it. You'll never avoid it. So at least, let's have people associate the two together. One last practical concern from Otterson. In that same interview, he noted that, quote, from the church's point of view, we much prefer to use the proper name of the church, but you've got to balance that against the reality that you can't fit nine words, the full name of the church, into a headline, so the media will always tend to use the shortened version. So this context that we've laid out hints somewhat at how we arrived at Russell Nelson's 2018 statement, but I assume it also leaves you scratching your head that we arrived there at all. There were no doubt many robust discussions about this behind closed doors, and unless Ryan McKnight wants to hand me a sheaf of papers right about now, no? We'll just have to wait to see how this latest development in Mormon identity occurred and how it'll play out. The one obvious difference I see now compared to previous waves of history is that concrete and physical changes took place. Perhaps someone responsible for URL changes and SEO optimization at LDS headquarters could present next year at Sunstone. That would be fascinating and, I assume, very revealing. And I, for one, look forward to hearing from Lindsay about that proposal being submitted. Thanks.
Turn this light off, or does it bother anybody on the screen? Okay, we'll just leave it then. First of all, I'm very grateful to be on this panel with such amazing people. Michael knows his religion, Brian enjoys his religion, Lindsay lives her religion, and many people feel like I have left the religion because I'm a fundamentalist Mormon, but really I claim to be trying to maintain the religion. I'm not here to speak as any kind of an official person that's representing the fundamentalist Mormons. There's thousands of them, and we're all very diverse. There are groups, and there are independents. I'm an independent. That means I've never joined a group. But I have been involved in a belief system that I claim as fundamentalist Mormon for over 50 years. I was a wife of Ogden Crowd. If some of you have heard him, he's an author of about 65 books on early doctrines and teachings of the church. So it's been my pleasure, really, to be involved in bringing this subject public. We wrote a book in December of 2002, called Voices in Harmony, and it was one of the first things that was positive about the principle of plural marriage. It has testimonies of about 100 women that were satisfied, adjusted, happy in the principle. So we do want to present that there's another side of polygamy than the ones that are stereotypical and that you hear in the media a lot of times. Probably ought to put on my Urim and Thummim here. This first paragraph's a little bit repetitive, but it doesn't hurt to review. President Russell M. Nelson's announcement that Latter-day Saint members should no longer call themselves Mormon did not originate with his August 2018 statement. It has been brought out as an apostle in 1990. He gave a conference talk with the same perspective. Then just about before the 2002 Olympics in Salt Lake, Church President President Hinckley publicly discouraged such phrases as the Mormon Church. Interestingly, in spite of all this, in 2010-11, it was the LDS aggressive advertising campaign entitled I'm a Mormon. And you could go to New York and find on buses a big I am a Mormon or advertising the Book of Mormon musical. But interestingly enough, this last announcement that President Nelson has made has caused some action, whereas the others kind of just got put aside. And the action is, for example, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir has changed their name to Tabernacle Choir at Temple Square. Deseret Book is making every effort to eliminate the word Mormon in the titles of their publications. On the other hand, Mormon Historical Association decided to keep their name as, and also Mormon Women for Ethical Government. In 2008, shortly after the death of President Hinckley and under the new administration of President Monson, the LDS Church made public another clear distinction in terminology, this time involving the LDS Church, the FLDS Church, and fundamentalist Mormons. And I've given several presentations where my introductory comments are always to distinguish between the difference of these terms. Excuse me. So in 2008, after the death of President Hinckley and under the new administration, the LDS Church made public the difference in these terminologies. Why did they do that? Could you remember what happened in 2008 in Texas? It was a raid against El Dorado FLDS members. And interestingly enough, for 36 days straight, the LDS Tribune had on the front page news about that event. You can imagine how that would be reported across the United States and even worldwide and try and get the terms correct. So I don't blame the church for coming out with an official statement clarifying the difference between FLDS and LDS. News articles appeared, and many times people didn't understand the confusing reports, let alone the reporters that were reporting it. The problem were these confusing, widespread reporting about separate entities, and there was a serious concern then, not only for the LDS Church, but also for fundamentalist Mormons, because people get FLDS confused with fundamentalist Mormons as well. So there's a distinction that we've tried to educate people. It's impossible to do that. There was an author, scholar, that just came over from Finland recently, about 3 weeks ago, and he showed me on his computer what had appeared on the Finland radio that very morning. It said Warren Jeffs was, for a period of time, president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Well, so you can see the problem, and I'm sure you realize that that's existed for a long time. And so just like the term Mormon, I don't know if that's ever going to completely change, because you can't get this message out to everybody. It's been used for so long that people are used to it. So spokespeople from the Principal Voices Coalition, which were representatives of the various fundamentalist groups, except for FLDS, we went before the media for interviews and so forth, countless practically, to try and clarify what was really happening down in Texas and try and correct the terminology. We went on Larry King Live and New York Times and Associated Press and Fox News and Salt Lake Tribune, People Magazine. I mean, it was countless interviews. And in a way, we were really glad for the opportunity to try and clarify the definition of these terms so people could understand them better. I think I've probably explained pretty much the difference between LDS and FLDS, but for those who don't know, FLDS is Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, so you can see the confusion. Then in trying to separate the definition between FLDS and Fundamentalist Mormon, the FLDS is one group that has come because of a breakoff, I guess, from the mainstream Mormon church. And so they involve, well, today you can't even put numbers on it because they're very factioned, and many of them no longer really are considered a religious entity. They're more like they live in Hilldale, Colorado City. But if you count those numbers, you're comparing oranges and apples because they are not really members of the FLDS Church in many cases. And so we had tried to give numbers for the different groups. And now it's very hard to have a number for FLDS because so many of them have left. So we've tried to explain, like Fundamentalist Mormons, there's many thousands of them. My figures have come up with between 36 and 38, and they're fluctuating all the time. But so for decades, the LDS church leaders and Fundamentalist Mormons have made every effort to make these distinctions with these terms. When using the term Fundamentalist Mormon, technically I'd like to point out that that's the way we term it, is Fundamentalist Mormon, because we want the emphasis to be on Mormon. It describes what kind of Mormons we are as compared to mainstream, Orthodox, non-Mormons, ex-Mormons, Jack Mormons, whereas the fundamentalist part, it describes Mormon, but the important word is the noun Mormon. People are going to go ahead and call us whatever they want, but that's the way we'd like to be seen, as the important emphasis on the term Mormon. On the other hand, emphasizing the term fundamentalist, Michael Quinn was asked to do a chapter for a book out of the University of Chicago Press. It was entitled Fundamentalisms and Society, and he was asked to write a chapter on the fundamentalist part of the Mormon Church. So in that case, they would be emphasizing fundamentalists because it included the fundamentalist aspects of worldwide religions. According to Neil Bringhurst and John Hamer in their book Scattering of Saints, quote, there are currently 80 active groups that trace their religious roots to the faith founded by Joseph Smith. Thus, the term fundamentalist Mormons helps to distinguish us from all the other 80. As previously mentioned, the unclear media reporting on this Texas FLDS raid in 2008 caused many members of the public to be confused, thinking there was some kind of affiliation between the FLDS and the LDS Church. For example, on July 9th and 10th, as a result of a previous LDS poll of 1,000 Texans, Salt Lake Tribune, Desert News, and Associated Press all reported, quote, more than a third of those surveyed thought the FLDS sect was part of the Mormon Church based in Salt Lake City. So the confusion continues. Thus, the LDS Church made a sincere effort to further clarify the differences in these two organizations. On June 24th, 2008, shortly after the raid, an official letter was sent from Elder Lance Wickman, General Counsel for the LDS Church, to publishers of major newspapers, TV stations, magazines, in which he stated, quote, over the years, in a careful effort to distinguish itself, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has gone to significant lengths to protect the rights in the name of the church and related matters. Specifically, we have obtained registrations, and that's a key word I'll explain a little later, for the name Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, another one Mormon, another one Book of Mormon. In other words, they have applied for a registration, restricted usage of those terms. Also in this same official letter, they requested that the media refrain, quote, refrain from referring to members of that polygamous sect, FLDS, as fundamentalist Mormons. They didn't want us, them using that term anymore. Thus, it was assumed by all fundamentalist Mormons when this announcement came out that it applied, that instruction applied to all of us, and not just to those belonging to that one particular group. So as a result, Principal Voices decided we better issue a press statement in response to that. And we stated, quote, the Principal Voices Coalition has learned that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has sent a letter to media outlets asking that the term fundamentalist Mormon not be used in the recent In the recent past, the church has insisted that we instead be defined as, quote, polygamous sects, S-E-C-T-S, even though most of us are not and do not refer to ourselves as polygamous. In a study I did recently, there's probably fewer than 50% of those people that call themselves fundamentalist Mormons that are actually living in a plural family. But the difference is that they probably believe in it, along with many other early doctrines of the church. Continuing on with the Principal Voices response, we strenuously object to any efforts to deprive us and others of freedom to name and describe ourselves by terms of our own choosing. Fundamentalist Mormons have been referred to by that name since the 1930s, often by the church members themselves or church leaders. And then goes on, we are proud of the term of our Mormon heritage. Plural marriage is only one of the tenets of our religion. The gospel of Jesus Christ is restored through Joseph Smith. For decades, it's interesting to compare this, for decades the LDS Church has identified themselves as being a Christian church, even though other churches label them otherwise. You've probably all heard, oh, the LDS Church is not a Christian church. However, by the same token, we feel we have the right to identify ourselves as fundamentalist Mormons in the same way that the church is making an effort to clarify themselves and define themselves, we would like to define ourselves. Church leaders have incorrectly, we feel, identified and labeled fundamentalist Mormons as polygamous sects, even though most of us are actually not living polygamy. By using that term, polygamous sex, we are denied an accurate description of our true identity. As Mary Batchelor, a spokesperson for Principal Voices in 2008, explained, quote, I think it's ironic that the church feels comfortable telling people that they can't be considered Mormon when they themselves have experienced the same thing from Christian denominations telling them they can't be called Christians. And they obviously clearly do believe they are Christian. Well, Mary said, I clearly do believe I'm a Mormon. It is reaffirming to me to read what two LDS scholars had to say about the rights that fundamentalist Mormons have to use the term Mormon. The first one comes from John Walsh, who was an expert witness in the case of Texas raids in 2008. And he says, I don't know how you can't call them fundamentalist Mormons. A Mormon is someone who believes in the Book of Mormon, who has belief that Joseph Smith was called of God in some way. The second quote along those lines was by B. Carmen Hardy. He was an author and a really an expert on the history of polygamy in the church. Quote, from a fundamentalist point of view, they are the real Mormons because they continue to adhere to Smith's original teaching that polygamy brought exaltation in heaven. So it's unclear as to really when the term fundamentalist Mormon began to be used. However, it was probably in the 1930s. And there's two quotes that show that both a church leader and a fundamentalist leader used that term about the same time. This first quote, and this comes from A Scattering of Saints by Newell Bringhurst and John Hamer. Quote, LDS Church President Gordon B. Hinckley has argued, quote, there is no such thing as a Mormon fundamentalist. It is a contradiction to use the two terms together. However, it was Marky Peterson, then a member of the LDS Quorum of 12 Apostles, who was apparently among the first to use the term, end quote. And then going on that same scenario, already by 1935, Joseph Musser, one of the early fundamentalist Mormon leaders, referred to himself and his fellow polygamists as Mormon fundamentalists. He argued that the term fundamentalist accurately described the priesthood council's refusal to accede to certain changes in the fundamentals of the gospel. Okay, on July 9th, in response to, Lee did this as a press release, and they printed it in the Tribune. And so for a few days, the church was printing something, and we were printing something, and it was kind of going back and forth. It was quite interesting. So on July 9th, in response to the Principal Voices press release, the LDS Church posted on the Tribune blog a four-point statement, once again attempting to bring some clarity to this issue so people will understand those practicing polygamy are in no way affiliated with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, often referred to as the Mormon Church. That's in a quote. On July 10th, the very next day, the church came out with an even more lengthy statement called, it was an official response, and it was a response to Principal Voices. It was entitled Proportion and Perspective on Polygamy Reporting. And my comment to that was that we certainly agree that they should continue to better inform the public and media about its true identity. But we feel a similar responsibility to inform the public about our true identity as well. However, we do take issue with one of the statements they made in that announcement. Quote, but when the term Mormon is stretched out of proportion to apply to any group, however large or small, aspiring to establish a church in the tradition of Joseph Smith, only confusion ensues. Well, I need to make it clear that fundamentalist Mormons have not attempted to, quote, establish a church. In fact, we're so diversified that it's only been recently that some of the groups and independents have met together with representatives to try and find something that we have in common, let alone organize a church. So going back to the LDS official letter of June 14th by the church, quote, we have obtained registrations, and I remember I emphasized that on a previous quote, for the name, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that's one term, Mormons, another, Book of Mormon, and two, through related trade and service marks from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. When they said this, I thought, I'm really wondering at to what point they have exclusive use of the term Mormon. I have a friend that's a lawyer. I went to him, and he did some research and found out that years prior to 2008, the church had applied for a registration, a registered trademark of the term Mormon. They were denied. So they applied again, and with restricting the areas that they wanted to get that registration for, they were denied one more time. However, they were granted a registration in the areas of education and genealogy. We do not use the term Mormon in either of those areas. So legally, we have every right to identify ourselves as fundamentalist Mormons. I'd like to point out, right at this point, talking about registration, the definitions of copyright, trademark, and registered trademark. Now, many of you probably know all the differences of this legal terminology, but I didn't, and so I looked it up. Copyright applies to a tangible item, such as a book, a work of art, a music item, literature, something you can hold on to, and you put the C with the O around it, that's copyright. A trademark applies to an intangible item, such as a slogan, a logo, a word, a phrase. So Mormon would apply in this field. Registered trademark applies to the above tangible items and is effective only if the trademark has been successfully registered with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. So I just thought it was interesting to make that clarification. In conclusion, on July 11th, 2008, Principal Voices Coalition listed the following on their website. And this kind of summarizes what I've been trying to say. Quote, the position of the Principal Voices Coalition is that the term fundamentalist Mormon, number one, describes our true identity and religious position. Two, does not apply to an established church, but is rather a descriptive generic term. Three, can be compared to the fundamentalist segment of nearly all world religions. They all have a fundamentalist part of their religion. And lastly, four, it has not been legally registered by the LDS Church for usage in the context that we use it. Thus, we plan to continue identifying ourselves as fundamentalist Mormons, and to paraphrase Martin Luther, here we stand.
Okay, we have about 15 minutes for questions, so if you just want to line up at the microphone.
Brian, I don't know whether you noted it or not, but there was an important difference between Russell Nelson in 1991 saying that we should use the full name of the church and the recent one, in that he was an apostle then, now he's a prophet. And he's claiming that it was a revelation. He said that God whispered it to him.
This is true.
That was a great presentation. I really enjoyed that. Two things. There's a bumper sticker out there that kind of has a little fun. It says on it, T-C-O-T-C-H-L-D-S. Whatever the initials are. It shows you how long the name is. It's like you can't put Mormon on a bumper sticker anymore, but you can only fit the initials. It's somewhere over here, so it's kind of fun if you want to pick that up. If this topic is interesting, tomorrow afternoon, 3:45, Michael Marquardt is going to tell a very interesting another chapter in this. And so if you like this topic, he's going to talk about how the name the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saint came about because of lawsuits, and the church was being attacked by creditors, and they changed the name of the church to avoid these lawsuits. So it's a very interesting thing, and Mike Marquardt has worked this out. Anyway, tomorrow afternoon I'm putting a plug in for that session if you like this topic.
Brian, get back to work. He works for me. And Anne used to, and now she's reminding me that she doesn't any longer. Can't tell her what to do. I'll just tell you a little anecdote first, and then I do have a question for them. But we've had a couple of people walk into our bookstore and say, well, right after the whole name thing happened, one of them said, so does this mean that we're ex-Mormons now? And somebody else said, I think that means we're anti-Mormon. So my question is, there's a lot of speculation about if this change, if we want to call it that, or going back to the original, is going to stick. Or will it change back again with new administration? So I'd like to hear what the panel has to say about whether this is, because we've seen a cyclical thing.
Should I stand up? Yeah. Okay, this is kind of a weird format for you to face them and me to face you. That's fine. So my opinion on this, everyone is, we've talked a lot about this, especially as Sunstone has this brand, there's more than one way to Mormon. I'm always thinking about the term and the identity, right? And what I've learned, my weird brag, is that I have unique and sometimes exclusive access to some of the most isolated cults in the American West. So thank you very much. And my work with some of these groups, I've learned that in order to really control a narrative and to control an identity, You have to control identity. You have to control an identity that some people can't escape. And we see this with Mormonism, this tension with this idea. If you leave the church, there's a lot of apostate rhetoric. It shows up in every group, but especially like the FLDS, they're one of the most extreme groups that use this. And the LDS church, we have a really robust apostate narrative. If you leave the church, leave it alone. You know, there's a lot of pressure in ex-Mormon communities for people to leave Mormonism alone. And I argue that if Mormonism is part of your identity, not just your religious belief, meaning if you grow up in the Wasatch Front, if you grow up in the Book of Mormon Belt, where Mormonism is more than just about what you believe, it's about your cultural identity, you're performing those signifiers I'm talking about, it's very difficult to leave. In fact, it's probably impossible. And that's why Sunstone recognizes ex-Mormons as a valid Mormon path, because it is. It's because so many Mormons go down that path. So that is to a long way to say that I think that it's impossible for this name to stick based on what I've seen. But I do think it's an attempt to sort of, you know, control an identity because, and I don't mean control is such a loaded word. We want to say it's like a pernicious thing. I don't mean it like that. As Anne has pointed out, there's an effort to distinguish ourselves. Like everybody wants to not be Warren Jeffs, right? Nobody wants to be that kind of Mormon except for Warren Jeffs and maybe like 10 other people. But so I think that that's part of it. But if you look at trends across social media, for example, I'll just give you an example. Like even me who, I mean, I live, breathe, and die Mormonism. It's my job. I get paid to do it. I was like searching a scripture, Nephi 2, the other day just to back it up. And I go to churchofjesuschrist.org and I click on it and I'm like, did they change their logo? Like, did this? Because I know they're making a lot of changes. And it was, I accidentally put the churchofjesuschrist.org and you get a fundamentalist sect. And I was like, this is not good. This is not good because Mormons, LDS people, Latter-day Saints, gosh, whatever we're called, don't want people to go to fundamentalism and they want to distinguish themselves from being fundamentalists. But their site is like three letters separate than a fundamentalist group that actually the doctrine is not that different. So I it took me a minute. I was like, wait a minute. So then I go to the church's actual site and it looks different. And I'm like, is this a fundamentalist site? What's going on? And I think that there's this confusion. So first of all, if we're just talking about social media, I can't even remember the name. Like you'll notice LDS.org is so much part of our parlance. And I would argue that this new change is an effort to control Mormon identity with more signifiers. So where I have seen it used is people who are, gosh, I'm trying to think of a charitable label. Everybody knows them. Everyone has the ward busybody that like wants to correct you if you do something wrong. Like if you come in and they're like, why are you tucking your garments, Sister Park? They're also the people that if you're on social media and you're all Mormons, you'll see them come on and they're like, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Please use the correct name of the church. I saw a woman in my ward in Stansbury. She was like, we are so grateful that we got to see, you know, the Mormon prophet, whatever, come to our, like one of the apostles showed up at their ward. And the first comment was, remember the correct name of the church. And I thought, this is just another way for people to judge who's in and who's out. So that was a long answer to your question, but no, I don't think it's going to stick.
I think the closer, the further away you get from Salt Lake and Utah, the harder it's going to be to change. Our local media are very aware of the church and its influence and its name and all that, and I think they'll make every effort to have the first reference the full name, and then after that, I don't even think they can use LDS Church. But I think when you get, like in Finland, when the radio comes out with Warren Jeffs for a period of time being president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, how are they ever going to get Mormon? You know, they aren't going to make any distinction. So I think the local will probably do the best they can, excuse me, to avoid Mormon, but the further away you get, it's going to be too hard to change.
Do you think that the more that the Book of Mormon, the historicity of the Book of Mormon being called into question is a trigger for the mainstream church moving away from being associated with Mormon?
Uh,
It's an interesting point that I hadn't really thought of. I would vote no. My sense is that it stems more from Nelson's personal emphasis on it, which predates a lot of the current Book of Mormon historicity debates. So I would argue it's linked more to him and his history than current events, if that makes sense.
I think the only way that would be possible is if the LDS Church made a concerted effort to move away from the Book of Mormon completely as a historical document. And I don't think that we're seeing those trends, especially not at BYU. There's still, I would say, I don't know how robust of an effort it is, but there are, you know, young generations of people that are arguing for the historicity of the Book of Mormon. So in order for that argument to stand, I think we would have to believe that the brethren themselves wouldn't believe in the historicity of the Book of Mormon, and I just don't see any evidence of that. I think that they do in some way, or they think it's at least worth arguing for. Now, that would be a wild day if the LDS Church moved away from the Book of Mormon, because then they would have to apologize for all the rumors they started about the Community of Christ. Sorry, not sorry.
All right, well, thanks for coming, and let's give a warm thank you to our presenters.